From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Yes, yes, yes. Welcome aboard. You are tuned in to Open Journal in Exile. It is Monday, September 14th, 2020. I'm Duane Bradley. Thanks for joining us.
And I'm Rick Campbell. And for Stephanie Coleman, who's on assignment today.
On this special In Exile edition of Open Journal, we'll be focusing on the United States Postal Service for the hour, visiting with Gordon Anderson and Jamie Partridge. And after the conversation, we'll wrap the program with a very special song of the week, fresh from Houston's own Bun B, as part of Mega Doom 2. It's a little something important about voting called The Future Is Mine, so stick around. That's coming up toward the end of this hour.
And as always, we welcome your feedback, opinions, and suggestions. Share your thoughts with us on Twitter with the hashtag KPFTOJ or find us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from the old school, by the way, and that's an open journal at kpft.org.
We'll be joining our guests, Jamie and Gordon, from the Postal Service in just a moment. But first, a couple things to just touch on. One, Rick, we passed a major milestone here the other day, the anniversary of the 9/11 catastrophes. Long time ago, it seems. And more recently, it's the 6-month anniversary since the World Health Organization declared this a global pandemic, this COVID-19 crisis that we seem to have been living in for way more than 6 months at this point, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking, I've been to New York a couple of times before the city was shut down, and it's just amazing to go down to the World Trade Center area. A couple of memorials for building imprints were, fountains all lit up, the new Freedom Tower, towers over south of Manhattan, and it's just almost like nothing ever happened down there. But now, with the pandemic, everything's happening and nothing's happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have some fond memories of that south end of the Battery Park area of Manhattan and harken back to those terrible days. We do want to also thank everybody who helped KPFT make its way through the sizzling summer fun drive. Those, I believe, 7 of you tuned in, we hope right now, who actually contributed specifically to Open Journal, helped us raise a good $700+ to help us continue to bring the People's Radio out over the ether to your little box, wherever you might be. So thanks for that. You are tuned in to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, the Mighty 90, listener-sponsored and commercial-free since 1970. 100,000 broadcast watts of people-powered public radio in public service to the Upper Texas Gulf Coast and beyond. Now in our 51st year in service, this is Open Journal, and we thank you for joining us. Welcome aboard. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Rick Campbell, sitting in for Stephanie Coleman, who's on assignment.
Yes, indeed. And we wish her well. And thanks, Rick. Well, the United States Postal Service has existed since 1775. The first Postmaster General was Benjamin Franklin. The United States Postal Service, a.k.a. the Post Office, delivers over 48% of all the mail in the world. It has a fleet of over 228,000 vehicles. It processes and delivers 182 million pieces of first-class mail daily. That's about 20 million pieces per hour, per day, all the time. And for 55 cents, you can send a first-class letter to anywhere in the United States of America. It employs over 600,000 people, nearly 500,000 of which are career people, and about 135,000 are contractors back as of 2019. It generates $236 million in revenue per day, and it costs the American taxpayer $0 for that service. Gordon and Anderson is a friend of the show, retired postal worker with 37 years as a letter carrier here in Houston, Texas. He served 10 years here as union representative in the National Association of Letter Carriers Local 283 with the aim of upholding the rights of letter carriers who were at times subject to management injustices. Gordon's currently the host of Black on Both Sides radio program airing right here on KPFT every Friday afternoon, noon until 2 p.m. on KPFT HD Channel 2. His show primarily focuses on issues impacting the diaspora, Black Pan-Africanist perspective. Jamie Partridge is a retired letter carrier from Portland, Oregon, is an organizer with CPWU, the Communities and Postal Workers United, a national network of local coalitions to save the postal service. You can find them at cpwunited.com. He's a member of the Rank and File Postal Organizers, a national network organizing to save the postal service during the pandemic. You can check them on Facebook through Save Our Postal Service. And in the past, he served as a shop steward, editor, organizing chair, and political director with NALC, that's the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 82, and is currently on the local union executive board. Jamie Partridge, Gordon Anderson, welcome to this special edition of Open Journal in Exile.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you on board.
Well, the Postal Service is something that we've dealt with all our life. It was just there. It was a very important part of life in rural areas where I grew up. How did the Postal Service become a political football?
Who wants to take that?
The expert. Go ahead, right ahead, Jamie.
Oh, well, the Postal Service has been a political football since the very beginning. You know, Benjamin Franklin helped to organize the Postal Service as part of the revolution against the Brits, right? Connecting the committees of correspondence, overnight mail between New York and Philadelphia. You know, the Postal Service was established early on to increase communication between the people's, Jefferson's idea about an educated populace is necessary for a democracy. And so newspapers were subsidized so that just a myriad of newspapers were delivered to all to the people all over the early United States. It wasn't until President Andrew Jackson came along that the Postal Service was became a crony-based appointed situation where you basically had to be a member of the party in power to get a job with the Postal Service. That started to change during the Civil War. Urban free delivery was established in order for the soldiers to be able to communicate with their families. And then later on in the late 1800s, rural free delivery as the country expanded across the West. But certainly the workers themselves were unable to have an impact on their jobs or on the direction of the Postal Service for quite a number of decades, and had to beg Congress for any kind of changes or improvements in their working conditions or wages. And the Postal Service has been, for most of its existence, was a tax-supported and publicly owned. With the Postmaster General being a member of the cabinet, and it was in 1971, after the Great Postal Strike of 1970, the U.S. Post Office became the U.S. Postal Service, and started on the road toward privatization, became more of a business and less of a public service, and Ronald Reagan tried to out and out privatize the Postal Service directly, and every decade since, the Postal Service has faced all kinds of various attacks. But most recently, as you mentioned, our current resident in the White House has openly stated that the Postal Service is a joke, and that vote by mail is fraudulent, and that the Postal Service must not get the funds that it needs to survive because that would encourage voting by mail. That's the political football you're mentioning in the current situation. But let me assure everyone that the Postal Service has been a political football for the 240 plus years that it's been in existence.
So we mentioned in the open, Jamie, that there's, you know, roughly 500,000 workers in the Postal Service, and then another more than 100,000 contractors working within the Postal Service. That's a huge block of organized workers. And I've always considered it to be part of the civil service. You took a civil service exam and you would get a pretty good union job out of getting through that process of becoming a civil servant and then working in the post office. You'd end up having a pretty fair life out of that. Pretty good deal. How has the Postal Service remained organized, and how organized is it right now in the midst of this turmoil under the current regime? Gordon, you want to field that one?
Actually, I think Jamie would be better to answer that question. However, okay. What I'd like to add to is around 2006, when I was in, my experiences are certainly more anecdotal. Around 2006, if I remember correctly, there was an attempt to redirect funding that was going to the post office to allegedly subsidize retirement funds. I would say, and Jamie, please correct me, I know you would know, I would say 80 years into the future. And so that is when a lot of the funding, the direct funding to the post office, as I understand it, was really undercut a lot of the stability, the current stability that the post office is under. So I will add that to that particular situation and defer to Jamie to the other part.
Well, in answer to your question about organization of the workers, the National Association of Letter Carriers was established in 1886. So we've been around for a while. In fact, we were part of the great eight-hour movement for the eight-hour day. In fact, we were the first set of workers that, through an executive order, were granted an eight-hour day. So we've been part of the labor movement in this country for that long. But as I said, we were restricted from collective bargaining as other unions do for wages, hours, working conditions. We basically had to beg Congress for any and everything, and for a long time, we, had to buy our own uniforms. We didn't have regular schedules. We weren't paid overtime, all that. But in 1970, in the midst of the great turmoil of the day, which was the Black Freedom Movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and all this social upheaval, including public sector workers going on strike illegally, teachers, sanitation workers, transportation workers, and especially in New York City, the postal workers decided, yeah, us too. And a lot of these postal workers in March of 1970 were people who had been hired as veterans from the Vietnam War, who were, there's veterans preference in the Postal Service. There's this more than 20% of postal workers are veterans. Because of anti-discrimination in hiring, and because of a specific government program to reach out to hire Black workers after the rebellions of the 60s to quiet the ghetto, right? A lot of Black, there's like 25%, maybe it's more, of postal workers are African American. So this mix of young, upset workers who were watching, being part of this social upheaval of 1970, walked out because their wages were so bad that they qualified for food stamps, and some of their families qualified for welfare. And it was a wildcat. I mean, the union leadership was, whoa, you don't do this. It's illegal for federal workers to strike. Not only could you lose your job, but you could be thrown in jail, and we could be thrown in jail, the union leadership, right? But the New York postal workers walked out, and it just spread like wildfire across the country, all the major urban centers. And 8 days of a strike just crippled the economy, and the economy was much more dependent on mail at that time, especially Wall Street right there in the center of New York. So out of that came significant increases in wages and the right to collective bargaining for wages and working conditions. And the postal workforce now has four unions. The two main ones are the National Association of Letter Carriers, which is the city letter carriers, the American Postal Workers Union, which is a hybrid that came together out of that strike, which includes the retail clerks, the clerks that sort the mail in the mail processing plants, the truck drivers, the maintenance people, and then the smaller unions, which are the rural letter carriers, the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, and the mail handlers, which are the folks that drive, push around the bags and throw the bags. And that set of four unions has been able to through the threat of strike, although the strike has not happened again, been able to negotiate wages and benefits that are much better than the rest of the federal workforce doing similar work, and certainly comparable to private sector unionized workers like United Parcel Service. But our unions are different. And in the current crisis, I have to say that the American Postal Workers Union is much more militant and active than the National Association of Letter Carriers in responding to this particular crisis. But that's a whole other story.
Okay. I wanted to kind of reference back to what Gordon mentioned. Back during the Bush regime, it was pushed through Congress, my understanding, that pre-funding of pension plans for the next 75 years was suddenly put on top of the United States Postal Service.
It's actually not pension plans. It's retiree health benefits.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for clarifying that. And so the general perception in much of the media since then has been portraying the post office as a money drain, because you will constantly see quarterly reports and annual reports saying billions of dollars in the hole, billions of dollars in the hole. And it allows folks to further politicize this as a losing proposition. So can you clarify what's the real story financially going on with that, referencing back to this 2006 Bush era, Bush 2 era?
Is that me again?
I think so. Yeah, because
I'm going to say off the top that I would say it's clear that Jamie has a more historical and broad based knowledge. You know, I was a postal worker and I enjoyed my job. I fought like hell for the people that I had to represent. But as far as developing an historical background and a historical love for what happened before, other than being a black carrier and going into the post office in 1976. Beyond that, I think we have the right man answering the right question.
All right. Back at you then, Jamie. Yeah,
thank you for your confidence, Gordon. I do consider myself part of the great tradition that Gordon referenced, that of delivering the people's mail for decades and representing the people in my station and in my craft. The Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006 was passed in the middle of the night in a lame duck session of Congress, and it fooled everybody, including my union was encouraged it, actually, at the time. The American Postal Workers Union was against it, but not many people realized that the Postal Service was about to go into, well, the whole country went into a major recession, the Great Recession, right after, in 2007. And all the, the surplus that the Postal Service had been producing year after year was going to go away. And that, not only has there been a steady decline in first class mail, which is the main source of revenue for the Postal Service, even though there's been a huge increase in package delivery and parcel delivery. And we're seeing that now during the pandemic too, a major decline in mail volume, but in huge increase in package volume. Packages take more labor to sort and to deliver than letters do. And they're not the money makers that letters are. So in that situation, even my union leadership looked at $5.5 billion a year, 10% of the postal budget going into pay for these health benefits for 75 years in advance. Well, the Postal Service could probably afford that. Well, it turned out that it couldn't afford that. And on paper, there's this manufactured debt, as you mentioned. But what's actually happening is that the Postal Service has been putting money. There's now somewhere between 50 and 75 billion in supposedly in this account for retiree health benefits, but it isn't even there. It's just like Social Security. It's been bent on, it's been spent on the wars in, you know, Afghanistan or whatever. It's just went right into the U.S. Treasury, and it was basically a maneuver to lower the deficit. But and as you mentioned, the Postal Service has this manufactured crisis, which needs to be alleviated. The House has passed a bill to eliminate this pre-funding mandate for retiree health benefits. The Senate has done nothing. But also, there's tremendous costs connected to COVID and the pandemic. Not only have tens of thousands of postal workers gone off work because of being infected or having to quarantine, instead of what, 85 have died, but the revenues have plummeted because, you know, businesses being closed, advertising mail going way down. So the Postal Board of Governors, even the Trump-appointed Postal Board of Governors, said that the Postal Service needed $25 to $50 billion to prevent it from running out of money by 2021, by next year. And the outgoing Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, you know, testified before Congress, we need this, the Postal Service needs this. And the House passed a bill twice, maybe three times, you know, in the stimulus packages for $25 billion for the Postal Service for COVID-related expenses. And the Senate has refused. And it's basically been a negotiation between the Democratic leadership and the White House. You know, the White House is saying, no, we're going to bail out the airlines. We're going to bail out the cruise ship lines, but we're not going to bail out the Postal Service. And that's because, one, of course, Trump wants to rig the election. And I'm not the only one saying that. That Trump wants to make sure the mail-in balloting doesn't happen or doesn't work right, or, you know, that there's all kinds of problems so the election can be called fraudulent. But also, it's a step on the road toward degrading the service even further. The major agenda of not only the Trump administration, but, you know, Wall Street, is to privatize the Postal Service. The Trump administration came out with a study in 2018 saying that the Postal Service should be privatized. It's, you know, it's right out there. And so that's the ultimate goal, is to, the Postal Service is, you know, it's a $75 billion a year business. You know, the profiteers could, if they could skim off the cream, you know, the profitable portions of the Postal Service, and just leave the rest, you know, the rural delivery, and, you know, the low-income neighborhoods where there isn't much going on that generates profit, they can make a big buck. And that's the long-term goal, and that's the 1%, and that's the big fight that we have on our hands when it comes to the finances of the Postal Service. Sorry, I threw everything in there.
No, that's really good. I want to remind everyone, you're tuned to Open Journal here on Pacifica Radio. And we're having a wide-ranging discussion on the state of the United States Postal Service, the post office in general, with Jamie Partridge and Gordon Anderson, both deeply involved and workers within the Postal Service for many years, and organized labor within the Postal Service and civil servants. Happy to have them on board. Happy to have you tuned in. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Rick Campbell, sitting in for Stephanie Coleman, who's on assignment today. I'd like to kind of change your focus a little bit about the boss of the Postal Service, Louis DeJoy. Political appointee, obviously, raised millions and millions of dollars for Trump. Is he there to fix it, or is he there to break the Postal Service?
I'll try to handle that question. I think you asked if he wanted to break the post office.
Yes.
I'm going to refer to the really excellent and lucid explanation that Jamie made, he laid out the blueprint clearly. Not only is Trump attempting to break the post office, there are many other infrastructures within the government that he is trying to undermine. Many people have accused him of wanting to break the post office, quote unquote, in order to win the election. My position on that is that most people, the vast majority of people, as I believe, walk to the polls and do their voting in person. And I believe that the mail-in ballot, even though I have done a mail-in ballot before, being over 65, for me, the mail-in ballot is, I can't call it superfluous, but I don't understand how it could be as significant as it is being played up or being portrayed in order to swing the election one way or the other. However, back to the issue of what is Trump trying to do. It, clearly, as stated before, he's attempting to steal the election, and by hook or by crook, whether it's by mailing ballots, whether it's by scrubbing the rolls from voters, whatever it is taking for him to maneuver the election in his direction, he's going to do that. So the post office is an easy target. You know, again, as Jamie mentioned, there's a very large minority presence in the post office. It has been a stair step to, I can't say a lucrative life, but certainly a comfortable life. There's an excellent retirement plan that I used to hear about all the time. And now that I've retired, I realize that I really, really have an excellent retirement situation, including my insurance. And so the post office was really a safe haven for many African-American workers and people that just came out of high school, not college graduates. But the post office has maintained itself, has maintained me and my family and most of our work, all of our workers, through the 80s when we had the Great Depression, through the 2000s when we had the Great Depression. My checks still came in. My retirement checks are still coming in. And I think despite what Trump tries to do or attempts to do, I look forward to receiving my retirement into the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, I would certainly echo that. And the Postal Service has really, really been a financial stability within the Black community. I mean, all over, you know, every major city, there are lots of Black postal workers. And to take the Postal Service down, to bust our union, to privatize and you know, cut the wages, which is basically what the agenda is, would have a huge impact on Black communities everywhere. The question that you asked about the new Postmaster General, and is he there to fix it or to wreck it? It's clear to me and anybody with a few eyes open that he's there to wreck it, that the most egregious move immediately following the new Postmaster General's coming into office in mid-June was to order that all the trucks had to run on time, whether they had mail in them or not. I'll try to explain quickly how, you know, mail gets processed at these big mail processing plants, sorted and then sent out by truck to the post offices, where then the letter carriers get their mail and take it out to the street. And the trucks now have to run to the station, from the plants to the stations, on time, whether or not the mail has all been sorted, you know, processed in the plants or not. So, yeah, we have reports of postal workers all over, but also you can get reports from customers that mail is being delayed. And what's really horrific is medicines. 4 million packages of medications are delivered every day, 4 million. And, you know, 90% of veterans get their pharmaceuticals through the mail. And these people are, you know, this is life and death when you don't get your medicine in the mail, but it's being delayed because this is the new directive of the Postmaster General to, for what reason? Well, he says, I'm trying to make it more efficient. Well, that's bull. He's making it
with understaffing due to the COVID crisis. Yeah. So this it's impossible to get all the mail, you know, sorted on time and onto the trucks on time. And in the past, the postal workers have always just made do. You know, you hold the truck until everything's ready, or you send out a second truck. And now there's no second trucks. And there's all other various small things that the Postmaster General has started doing, which is, for example, removing mail processing machines. He's removed hundreds of these mail sorting machines, and it removed blue collection boxes and you know, various things to undermine and degrade the service. But beyond that, this person, Louis DeJoy, is corrupt and a criminal, which may take him down, which would be great. We're trying to emphasize the fact that he's destroying the Postal Service from within, but it may be his campaign finance shenanigans. For example, his past company, he has been just in the last couple of days, it's been revealed that by his employees that they were expected to contribute to Republican causes, and then they would be reimbursed by the company, you know, which is, of course, a criminal violation of campaign law. But, you know, there's all kinds of other things about Louis DeJoy that is not just criminal, but corrupt, where he has investments in a company that has contracted with the Postal Service. He has a $50 million investment in XPO, which has transportation contracts with the Postal Service, which means that he can pad that contract as Postmaster General, you know, and make money off of it for himself. He got the job because he's a top fundraiser for the Republican Party. And he got the job because the chair of the Postal Board of Governors is the top fundraiser for Mitch McConnell. You know, I mean, it's all this web of corruption. So our group, rank and file postal organizers, has a campaign currently going to target DeJoy through the Board of Governors. In other words, we're encouraging people to contact members of the Postal Board of Governors who are not politicians, who are not used to getting pressure, who are not, who are like, this is just one of the board of directors that they happen to be on. And you can go to our Facebook page, Save Our Postal Service, and find the addresses, the emails, and the phone numbers for the Postal Board of Governors. And if they're in your town, go visit them. Go visit their place of business. Go visit their home. We're encouraging people to, knock on their door, leaflet their neighbors, put pressure on the Postal Board of Governors to dump DeJoy. And I think that would help at least in cutting the momentum toward degrading the service and privatizing the Postal Service.
You're tuned to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio. This is the Open Journal program, and we thank you for joining us. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
I'm Rick Cavill. I'm sitting in for Stephanie Coleman today.
Gordon, I wanted to drop a local question on you. Here in Houston last week, we saw in the Chronicle that Mayor Turner was questioning the local postmaster, one Corey Richards, about the refusal of more than a dozen of Houston's 86 post offices to allow multilingual voter registration materials that were produced by the League of Women Voters, a nonpartisan organization. Do you have any insights into that story? Anything you could share with our listeners on that?
I honestly have to say that I have no particular insights that I can share, simply that these locations have always been traditionally open to these types of materials, and for several, and it has to be a unilateral thing by the station manager if it's only a few. If they're making unilateral decisions like that, then clearly they're going against some guidelines somewhere along the way that I can't point out per se, but I think that before it's over, they'll be put back in line, and I'm sure these materials will get out where to all the people that need to get them, particularly the Hispanic community, because obviously you well know that Houston is basically a Hispanic city. So we do need to serve all of the constituencies in the city.
Jamie, could you tell us about the Communities and Postal Workers United and what your purpose is and what kind of work you're doing right now?
Sure. We're a coalition, a network of local coalitions to save the People's Postal Service from attack, which emerged in 2012, really, as a series of attacks were coming at us from the Postmaster General at the time, Donahoe, who was attempting to eliminate six-day delivery to cut out Saturday delivery, and then to close or consolidate mail processing plants and he proposed to close half the mail processing plants in the country and close half the post offices in the country, mostly rural post offices. And so we were getting this was, you know, coming off of the, you know, the Great Recession and the, you know, the mandate of pre-funding. And so we pulled together a group that, because we felt that our national unions weren't doing enough to fight back, they were just basically encouraging members to call Congress. And so we organized a set of direct actions, which included a hunger strike in Washington, D.C., where we were sitting in congressional offices, and we camped out on the National Mall, and we occupied some of these meal processing plants that were faced with closure, as well as some of the post offices. We were able to get a suspension of the closures of mail processing plants, but they did close half the mail processing plants. We were more successful in getting stopping most of the closures of post offices, but lots of the hours were reduced. And at that time, the American Postal Workers Union got a whole new slate of leaders in the at the headquarters, which happened to had take a more proactive approach to fighting this fight. And the next big battle that we were faced with was the outsourcing of post offices to Staples office supplies. There were 1,500, you know, this chain of Staples office supply that the post office basically set up postal services inside of Staples, run by, you know, low-wage, non-union Staples workers who were not, you know, correctly trained, and, you know, there was security problems and all that. And a three-year battle, which included lots of picketing and store occupations and, invading stockholders meetings and things, those kinds of things. We won. We got the Postal Service to back off from its Staples contract. And we got a number of different changes, including bringing back some of the trucking that had been outsourced to the private sector, and some of the maintenance and all that. So the Communities of Postal Workers United has continued, although the struggle kind of went into a lull for a while. And now, you know, during the Trump administration, especially during this pandemic, a whole new set of postal workers and allies. And when I say allies, I'm particularly talking about veterans organizations, seniors organizations, rural organizations, small business people who are especially impacted and reliant on the Postal Service have come together. There is who are again trying to figure out ways of taking the spirit of the 1970 strike, maybe without a strike, but maybe we'll have to get there, you know, to put pressure on the power brokers, the decision makers, whether it's Congress or the Postal Board of Governors. And so we've organized a series of actions. This is our rank and file postal organizers group, which communities and postal workers is part of, but now this is a much larger group, including vigils and marches and car caravans, and during the pandemic we've joined up with other essential workers, you know, like grocery workers and hospital workers and folks that are, you know, on the front lines of the pandemic in pushing for, you know, personal protective equipment, for the kinds of safety measures that are needed to keep people safe. But we're also joining with the postal unions in doing massive call-ins, like we did in July 30,000 people called into Senate at the same time on July 23rd in order to try to push this $25 billion relief for the Postal Service. It didn't work. So we had an action on August 22nd and another action on August 25th, which were amazing. They were the biggest national days of action ever in support of the Postal Service. August 22nd, there were actions at 800 post offices across the country. On August 25th, at 300 post offices across the country. And these were people that were just like, I love the post office. I'm hearing that that Trump is trying to steal the election. I'm coming out in front of my post office with a sign. And, you know, it was very inspiring, and but it wasn't enough. The Senate, you know, the House came back in session and passed another bill for $25 billion, and the Senate is, you know, the Senate is back in session, but they're like, well, Postal Service, no, I don't think so. You know, so that's where we are. We're still in this fight with the Senate, and then, of course, with the Postal Board of Governors.
Well, as we begin to wrap this conversation, I'd like to get a sense from both of you, if I could, as to your feeling about whether or not it is actually going to be safe to send in a ballot by mail during this fall season, with all of the media attention focused on the disruption inside the Postal Service, the machines that have been yanked out of some of the sorting centers, the pictures of trucks with blue boxes hauling them away. I looked for my normal blue box and it's gone. I have to go way out of my way to find one now. The post office I used to have a P.O. box at is now a kolache shop and dental place. The other one that I now have to go out of my way to is got a for sale sign in front of it. It makes one wary. So do you think that this is going to be safe for people this fall?
Well, let me take that softball question there. it's clear that if you trust the work of the post office over the last 50 or 100 years, however long people have been around, nothing's going to change in that regard. I would doubt very seriously if there will be any kind of shenanigans that can redirect postal ballots. Personally, I would encourage people who vote in person. If it takes wearing a mask, do that. If it takes standing in line for hours, do that. Most places, certainly here in Texas, you can vote early. So there's plenty of opportunity to circumvent voting by mail. But if you have to, I would believe, and I would safely say that the mail is safe. But beyond that, I would like to say as well that this is why it's important, clearly, for those who listen to your show to get out and vote. I mean, it's redundant. It's pretty obvious. But I would expect if we change this regime to a Democratic administration, the post office would get a lot more relief than it has now. You'd have a lot more friends than you have now. And so it's so important. I mean, voting for Trump or Biden is not the issue. It's about changing the whole dynamic of how things will be happening. And lastly, I'd like to say I really appreciate Jamie Partridge, because as you can see, this is why we talked to him years ago, 10 years ago, because Portland was clearly the vanguard of the radical push for postal workers to do their work. So we're talking to today, probably the spearhead of many of those things that were going on in Portland. You can go back, you can see pictures where people are in the streets. So again, I really appreciate what you guys do in Portland, and keep up the good work. And keep me on your mailing list.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Gordon. All right. If I could just quickly answer that same question.
Yes.
The pandemic is going to force many, many more people to vote by mail. Now about 10% of the country votes by mail. It'll be more like 40 or 50%. Wow. And that's going to be really difficult for local elections divisions who are not used to that. In most states, you have to apply. You know, Oregon, everybody votes by mail. We've been doing it for decades. But, you know, most states you have to apply for an absentee ballot. So people need to apply early and vote early. You know, that's the main advice that I would give in this current situation, and help us in the struggle beyond the election to save the People's Postal Service.
So, Jamie Partridge, could you share the best contact information for people who want to keep in touch with this movement to save our Postal Service?
Hour by hour updates. Save Our Postal Service is a Facebook page, Save Our Postal Service. And the website of Communities and Postal Workers United is cpwunited.com.
Okay. Well, I want to really thank both of you for your work and service to the community and what you've done over the years. I am a big fan of the post office since I was a wee one. I've learned a lot of my history by collecting stamps that my mother shared with me when I was a little kid, and that's just a little sidebar. So, Gordon Anderson, Jamie Partridge, thank you so much for joining us on this special edition of Open Journal.
Good to see you all.
Thank you.
Solidarity.
Thank you.
Power to the People's Service.
Exactly. And it's right on time. I have 5% on my battery.
Okay.
All right.
Perfect.
Thank
well,
you.
As we approach the conclusion of this special edition of Open Journal, it's time for that very special song of the week we promised at the top of the show. We'd like to recommend you check out the YouTube video of this powerful tune as well, of course, after the program. There's many moving images from the recent news in the streets, and also some powerful photos drawn from the award-winning work of friends of the family and founders of Photo Fest, Wendy Watrous and Fred Baldwin, from their years living out in Navasota back in the early 70s. So here it is. It's from Mega Doom 2, featuring Bun B and Mr. Biggs. The Future Is Mine is the Open Journal Song of the Week.
One step forward and two steps back. Two steps forward and one step back. One step back, one step back, one step back, one step back.
We try to douse the fire, it continues to burn. Like the boogie down prompt, it continues to burn. Like that chorus in the yard, it continues to burn. Can't you see the fire, it continues to burn.
Columbus made his living on the deep blue sea. Yo, he wanted to get paid and make some history. When he hit the new world, they welcomed him with open arms. Then he cut out their tongues and wore them like charms. Yeah, they wore them like charms. Charm like, charm like. Take all the gold. Then they spread a new disease. It weren't no common cold. Grab the men by the balls and put them all in chains. We'll make them build our castles when we get them back to Spain. Their future is mine. They made a proclamation in 1863.
all persons held as slaves.
His folks shall be free. But if you find yourself in Selma, you best get out of town.
So the brother hopped the railroad that took him underground.
One step forward.
Memphis made an unexpected stop. The conductor executed by a Klansman and a cop.
They grabbed the brother's head,
dragged him naked through the town.
Strung him, hung him, burned him. How you like your freedom now, boy?
How you like your freedom now,
boy? How you like your freedom now?
Number 42 broke the color line, but when he got off the diamond, he was just another shine.
You ain't my dodger, only way you get a room
is if I tell you
batter up and you grab the broom.
Batter up.
No solution, education, elevation. There ain't no United Nations. Fantasy,
reality.
Look around, tell me what you see.
The future's up to you and me. We control our destiny. We control our destiny. We control our destiny.
And hands,
dead cops to play their hand.
Fed the kids,
taught them pride,
told them all about genocide.
They showed them how to make a stand, that this here ain't no promised land.
But a line was drawn in the sand when Nixon came to town.
One by one they met their end. Jail or grave they wouldn't bend. Sister Davis, Sister Brown, Bobby Seale, they all went down. Eldridge Cleaver, soul on ice, went and found him, Jesus Christ. But Hampton, he had too much power. They gave that cat a bullet shout.
They gave that man a bullet shout.
200,000 strong in the place to be. Marching down on Washington in 63. The king, he had a dream, he had a noble vision. To make love and peace and prayer his only ammunition.
5 years later, he was preaching about a mountaintop. He knew his day was coming, but you couldn't make him stop.
Take my hand, precious Lord, were the last words he would preach.
Then James Earl Ray obliged him with a bullet through the cheek.
They let you take a seat, but you ain't never in the game. They give with one hand
and take with the other.
And every day we're losing more sisters and brothers.
One step forward and two steps back. One step forward and two steps back. One step forward and one step back.
That was The Future is Bright from Mega Doom 2 featuring Bun B and Mr. Biggs. Open Journal Song of the Week. Remember to check out the YouTube video of this piece as well, which we'll link to on our Facebook page. You can suggest a local artist or tune by reaching to us through the socials or emailing us old school, openjournal@kpft.org. It is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. I'm Dwayne Bradley. Please subscribe to the podcast, KPFTOJ. Thanks to all of you who pledged to KPFT and to the donors to this program. Appreciate it very much.
And I'm Rick Campbell, sitting in for Stephanie Coleman today. He'll be back with us next week. And we are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including, of course, Stephanie, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. Be here with us for Open Journal next time for more great conversations. Thanks for your support.
Hey, and for now, we always like to leave you with our thought of the week. This comes from America's first Postmaster General, Benjamin Franklin, who said, "Tricks and treachery are the practice of fools that don't have brains enough to be honest." Take care of each other.